Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. Say you're a journalist and your newspaper wants you to use Twitter, or you need to figure out how to master the latest technological trends. Who do you turn to? A lot of people turn to the Poynter Institute for the latest news and trends in media today. Mallory Jean Tenori is the managing editor of the Poynter's website, poynter.org. She writes about social media, new tools for long-form journalism, women in technology, and how to do corrections in a fast-paced digital environment. How are you doing, Mallory?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Now, we've been emailing each other for a couple of months, I've been bugging you for a couple of months, sending you links to our podcast and trying to get to come on and talk about some of the things you write about. Not too long ago, you did a little crowdsourcing, looking for input on advice from working journalists for young journalists. Can you tell me about that story and what you found out?
Sure. Well, the story is about 10 ways that journalists, young journalists in particular, can make themselves more marketable. And it actually came out of a presentation that I gave at my alma mater, Providence College. And the idea was that I want a journalist to just get a better sense as to how they can get a job and how they can put themselves out there. And since I was doing all this preparation already for the talk, I figured, well, I might as well write a piece about it, and then I can use this piece actually in my presentation. And so I had a bunch of tips that I already wanted to share, but since this wasn't a big scoop and I wasn't afraid that someone else was going to take this story, I said, well, I might as well let my Twitter followers know what the story is that I'm working on. And so what I did was I just sent out a question on Twitter, and I said, writing a piece about ways that young journalists can make themselves more marketable, what advice should I give them? And so I wasn't sure what sort of feedback I would get, but I ended up getting about dozens of responses from people who clearly were pretty passionate about this and wanted to share advice. And there were so many comments coming in that I decided to put them together in a Storify. And for those who don't know, Storify is essentially a tool that lets you tell a story using different social media elements. So I pulled these tweets together in a Storify and embedded that in the bottom of my story. And when it came time to give the speech at Providence College, I was able to read off a lot of these responses that people had given. And it was a great way to be able to get different voices into my piece and to really use Twitter as a way to advance my reporting.
So were there any of the suggestions that sort of jumped out at you that you hadn't even thought of?
Yeah, that's a good question. One was math and stats. And someone said, seriously, you can learn programming anytime. And that one I thought was interesting because it was a little bit different from some of the others. So there's been a push in recent years for journalists to learn more about computer science and programming. And at News University, which is part of Poynter, there's a course on math for journalists. And so I like the idea of thinking not just about the literary side and sort of the writing side of things, but also thinking about learning new skills that might not traditionally be associated with journalism.
Now, you actually came to Poynter as a young journalist yourself in a summer young journalist program, and then later on as a year-long fellowship. Could you just talk about how that sort of came about?
Sure. Well, when I was in college, I knew I wanted to be a journalist, and my school didn't have a journalism program, but I was editor of our school newspaper and had different internships. And at the time, it was right before newspapers started to do a lot of layoffs, and this was 2007. And I wasn't seeing too many job openings, but I just decided that I was going to put together a bunch of my clips and resume and cover letter and send it out to as many different news organizations as I could. So I sent out about 75 of those pamphlets with my clips and resume. And then I also was making connections along the way. So I found out that Roy Peter Clark, who's the vice president of Poynter, was actually a graduate of Providence College, and there weren't too many journalists who graduate from Providence College that I was aware of, so I decided to reach out to him, and we were actually going to a national writers workshop together in Connecticut, and so we decided we were going to meet up there, and when we met, he automatically sort of became this mentor for me, and he said, oh, you should apply for this six-week fellowship that the Poynter Institute has. And I had heard about Poynter. I wasn't too familiar with it, but the more I looked into it, the more I realized that it would be a good place to be as a young journalist. So I ended up applying for that position. And I also applied for a year-long Naughton Fellowship, which was named after Jim Naughton, who was the former president of the Poynter Institute and longtime journalist. He just recently passed away a few months ago. And so I ended up getting into the six-week fellowship program, and then from there was chosen as the one to go into the year-long fellowship. So really making that connection with Roy and then also the experience I gained in college was a huge help.
And that seems to be one of the things we've gotten out of this podcast is we've had a chance to talk with a lot of working journalists, and you know we've posed them questions about how people can you know, young people can get into journalism, and it really does seem your story is one of connections, that you reach out and you meet somebody who may not be that person who has a job, but he or she may be able to mentor you or help you or point you in that direction. I know in my own career I've had many opportunities like that. Now, just sort of to backtrack a little bit back to young journalists, crowdsourcing, social media, et cetera, you know, what skills do you think young journalists should be picking up besides, you know, the one that you'd sort of mentioned, which is math for journalists?
Right. Well, I think that young journalists in particular, need to be able to strike a balance between traditional journalistic skills like reporting and editing, and mix those with more sort of modern-day skills that journalists need. And many of those skills relate to social media, and they also relate to programming and thinking about stories in new ways. So one of the things to think about is how can you perhaps create a new position for yourself or create something that hasn't already been created? For a long time, I think journalists were in this mindset that they needed to sort of just go back to what they had been doing and think about it in new ways. But now, when I've been talking with young journalists, I'm realizing that some of them are actually wanting to create new things. And if you think about it, in the past few years, there have actually been new positions created at news organizations that have been responses to what's changing in journalism. So, for instance, now you see social media editors or social media managers, which, quite frankly, wasn't really a position you had in newsrooms 5 years ago. You're also seeing mobile managers, so people managing mobile. And you're seeing programmers and people who are doing sort of graphic interactives. So I think you want to be able to balance those traditional reporting skills with some of the new ones. And, you know, we talk a lot about social media, but one of the other things that I think would be good for young journalists to know is to gain a better understanding of mobile journalism and how we can adopt sort of mobile-first strategies in newsrooms. And I'm thinking about this particularly because we ran a piece on the Pointer site yesterday about five reasons that mobile will disrupt journalism like the internet did a decade ago. And in the piece, Corey Bergman talks about the need for sort of mobile journalism because that's where so many people are getting their news now. And we had a chat about this yesterday, a live chat, and we found in asking some poll questions, we found that a lot of people don't have people working specifically on mobile in their news organizations, and they don't have sort of a definite strategy for mobile journalism. So that's an area that I think is going to continue to grow and that young journalists could potentially help out more with.
You know, this is really intriguing that you're throwing out the mobile discussion at this point because, you know, what does that mean to people? I mean, I think people understand that, you know, I can read the New York Times on my phone or my iPad or whatnot, but from a thinking, from a journalist standpoint, from an editor standpoint, what does that mean? You know, how do you have to change your thinking to, you know, be a mobile journalist?
Right. Well, right now, what a lot of news organizations are doing is they're creating content for their website. They're creating content for their print product. And then they're simply taking that product and putting it on the mobile platform. What we need to be thinking about is saying, okay, well, how can we think about the mobile platform first? And then think about the other products. And, of course, it's not to say that the other products, like your online product, your print product, your broadcast product, are not important. But because so many people increasingly are getting news online, you want to be thinking about how you can create an advertising strategy for mobile, how you can be thinking about, you know, putting push alerts and breaking news alerts on mobile devices, and really sort of changing the way we think about where we're putting news first. In this piece that I mentioned about with Corey Bergman, he was talking about how years ago, when the newspaper industry was doing really well, you had Google and Craigslist come up, and they created these new business models enabled by the technology and the scale of the internet. And we later found out that Craigslist would really replace a lot of local advertising and take that away from newspapers. And so now we're at that time again in journalism where we are at this place where there's a great opportunity to take advantage of mobile. And frankly, social media sites like Facebook and Twitter are already really taking advantage of mobile in terms of distributing content on mobile devices and advertising on mobile devices. And so if news organizations don't really, you know, catch up or start to think more about mobile then, you know, these other news sites or social media sites could potentially have a bigger role in things than they do now.
When we talk about the disruption that occurred when, you know, the internet came along, and you started out your answer by saying, you know, oh, well, you know, that people generally will create content for their newspaper or whatever, and they'll just put it online or they'll put it in mobile. When newspapers, you know, first started having websites and designing websites, their thinking was, well, we're just going to imitate our front page, but it's going to be on the platform, the internet platform, whatever it is. That's going to be our website. And people discovered that those sites were very unattractive. They're very difficult to understand, you know, where the priority of the news story is, because it's not the same thing as holding a piece of paper or a magazine. That they had to change the design and their thinking for how they're going to present online. Now we have a new thing. It's mobile. And the websites that we've built to use on our laptops and our computers are not, you know, they're not responsive design. They're not, you know, delivering that mobile content in the quickest, most efficient manner. So, you know, what challenges do you think that creates for people who are planning websites, who are designing and things like that?
Right. Well, I think that's a good question, and that's a great comparison in terms of thinking about putting the print product online. I mean, one of the things to think about is trying to think about hiring or having people in your newsroom develop skills that are mobile related, so that you can be thinking more creatively about how you're putting your content on mobile devices. Because a lot of times when you go to a website on your phone, you can tell whether or not that site is optimized for mobile. Oftentimes, if it's not, the dimensions aren't quite right, or it just isn't as user-friendly. And so you really want to be thinking about how you can make the experience as seamless for readers as it would be if they were to go to just your regular desktop website.
I sometimes feel that the newspaper was designed not so much for the ease of the reader, but maybe the ease of the printing press, that this is how we're going to create this thing. So people are just going to have to deal with the size and the shape of this. But once you get into a digital environment, it's really the user experience that's driving a lot of the thinking about story priorities and layout and design of your website. And certainly going into mobile, where, you know, just being able to have all that functionality in your hand as opposed to sitting in front of you is, you know, again, it's creating these sort of challenges in how we present our material to our readers. And, you know, the ease of being able to do things is so important. But, you know, it's sort of good to go back to the story you wrote about, you know, advice for young journalists and your decision to sort of crowdsource. Can we talk a little bit about crowdsourcing and you know, what's your thinking behind that?
Sure. Well, I think that crowdsourcing is a great tool for journalists. A lot of times I've used it in my reporting, and I've seen other reporters use it as well. So sometimes a reporter might be working on a story. Sometimes I'll see them use it if they're interviewing someone who is really high profile. And so a reporter will say, oh, I'm about to interview so-and-so. What question should I ask that person? And then they're able to see what their audience is interested in and what they're curious about. And so sometimes those journalists will then take those questions that they've heard and they'll actually pose them to the people they're interviewing. Other times, news organizations will use it for, say, storm coverage. So maybe there's a storm in the area or there's Hurricane Sandy, and news organizations want to be able to get people involved in that news gathering process. So they'll sometimes create a hashtag, meaning it's sort of something that groups tweets or groups photos together. And so some will create a hashtag on Instagram or on Twitter and say, send us your pictures using this hashtag. And then they'll be able to put those together in a Storify, or somehow they can compile them in their story that they're working on. And one thing to keep in mind with crowdsourcing is that, I mean, you don't necessarily want to make it seem as though everything that people are telling you is fact. I always say that social media is a great starting point. So it's such a good place to find ideas and find potential sources, but you always have to do your follow-up reporting and rely on your traditional journalism skills to actually verify whether the information you're getting is correct. So a lot of times what I use crowdsourcing for is not so much to get factual information, but it's to get people's opinions on something or to get their advice on something, similar to the advice that I got in the piece for young journalists.
And it provides you sort of that, you know, that interconnectivity with your audience to find out, you know, take the temperature, take the pulse of your reader and find out what interests them. And that can sometimes open up new questions for you and new ways to guide your story. What are your thoughts about the challenges of young journalists coming into the industry now? You know, you're fairly young yourself, but you've what advice would you have to somebody coming into a newsroom now?
This is always a challenge when I'm asked to give a speech to young journalists or talk with young journalists. I always want to be realistic but also optimistic. So one of the challenges, of course, is that news organizations aren't necessarily as hiring as much as they were, say, 10 years ago. And so the number of positions for young journalists is more limited. And sometimes I've had young journalists come up to me and say, well, should I even become a journalist? Should I get into journalism? And I always encourage them to still go into journalism. I mean, I think that journalism is a really noble field, and I think that we increasingly need smart people to be in the field to keep it going and to help us think about new ways of telling stories and distributing news. But I think that journalists just have to be smart and realistic about the fact that, you know, that space is limited in newsrooms and that newsrooms are having challenges. Even though there are layoffs and there are challenges, though, there are a lot more opportunities for new positions, like I was talking about with the social media managers and the mobile managers. And so I think the extent to which journalists can be open to not pigeonholing themselves is really important. So there's the young journalist who knows she really wants to be a reporter. That's great. But what I try and do is encourage that young journalist to say, okay, I like reporting, but what else could I do to advance my reporting skills? Maybe I should take on photojournalism, you know, take some photojournalism classes in college or try and do some photography at an internship. Or maybe I want to learn more about video. I mean, anything that you can do to make yourself more marketable and to develop more skills is going to help you in the long run as a journalist.
And I think it's also sort of important for us to encourage young journalists to sort of rethink their expectations about what types of jobs are out there. I mean, if you watch All the President's Men, you know, that's a certain type of newsroom in the 1970s. You know, a lot of those jobs, you know, they may still be there, but they're very different now, and the way to get into them is very different. That you have to be creative in thinking about, you know, what your skills are, what you want to do, and you know, as you said, there are a lot of new types of positions out there that require different things. I think on one hand, you want to be a generalist, but we've had people on our podcast who said, well, you know, yeah, be generalist up to a point, but, you know, concentrate on something. Concentrate on photography, sort of like what you were saying, or you know, concentrate on something that you're really good at. And make that the thing that you want to pursue and develop a career around. Now, tell us a little bit about Poynter and what resources it offers, not just for young journalists, but journalists in general.
Right. Well, just for those who don't know, Poynter is a nonprofit journalism school, and we own the Tampa Bay Times, which is the local newspaper here, so we have a close affiliation with them, although we work independently of each other. So the Poynter.org website is basically a media news website for journalists. And so we have two main buckets of content on the site. We have our media news, which is the news of the day, and then we also have how-tos, which are craft-based pieces that help journalists get a better sense of how they can do their jobs better. So that's sort of the resource that I spend my most time on, just in terms of writing and editing stories. But then we also have News University, which has a lot of great webinars and also courses, free courses that journalists can take just to develop more skills, either based on editing or reporting or video or programming. They have several different courses, and they also have online group seminars, which last for several weeks. So if you really want to delve into a topic, you can take that course for an extended period of time online. So those are sort of our two main online offerings, but then we also offer in-person training. And so we have several faculty members at the Institute who lead seminars. They're typically week-long seminars in which journalists who are already working in the field come to Poynter for more training, either on leadership and management or on reporting, editing, and writing or on mobile journalism. And so we hold those seminars, and we also are sometimes on the road. So our faculty will actually give sessions at colleges or in different places. We're actually having a seminar in Chicago in April, I believe, that's geared toward helping journalists improve gun coverage and their coverage of gun control. So sometimes we'll see something that's in the news or something that's happening right now, and like the Newtown shooting, and then we'll build a seminar based off of that.
One of my coworkers is actually taking a seminar on SEO, search engine optimization, and she's really loving it. And that's it's a topic that I'm interested in. There are all these topics that you know the more that you get into digital journalism, the more you get into journalism in general, you start finding all these little aspects of it, things that you'd like to know, and it's good to be able to know that there's a resource out there. Besides just, searching on Google. So let's talk a little bit about social media for a second. How do you work social media into what you're doing besides the crowdsourcing?
Basically, there are four people who work on our website full-time. It's myself, my editor, and then my editor, Julie Moose, and then Jeff Sonnerman and Andrew Bujan. So all of us are sort of working with social media and trying to use it to share the word about our stories and also to get more insights for our stories, such as through crowdsourcing. And so one of the things that we've tried to do is think about publishing as the start of a process of sharing. So traditionally, whenever you've published a story, you think, okay, well, that story's done, time to move on to the next one. And it sort of signaled an end. Whereas now, when you publish a story, it's just the beginning of your efforts to really share it. So what we do is we will publish a story, and then we'll tweet every story that we publish out on Twitter. And then we also will post about three or four of them on Facebook each day. And then we sometimes are using other social media sites as well, but Twitter and Facebook are our two main ones. And we also all have little lists set up in Twitter so that we can monitor whenever anybody mentions Pointer. So I'm usually monitoring Twitter throughout the day. I typically use TweetDeck, which is a third-party app, and I use that just to keep track of what people are saying. And I follow journalists because my beat is the media industry, so all of my sources are usually journalists. So I try and follow smart journalists and people who whose insights I really care about and whose opinion I value. And one of the things that you hear sometimes about Twitter is, oh, well, that's just a site to hear about what people had for lunch. And I say, well, that could be true if you're following the wrong people. I mean, there are some people who are tweeting that kind of stuff, but if you're following people who are tweeting about things that are of interest to you, or who are tweeting about things that you're covering as a journalist, then you're going to get a lot more value out of it. So I use Twitter really as my modern-day police scanner. I mean, it's what I'm using to get ideas, to see what journalists are talking about and what they care about. And in monitoring it, I'm able to get a better sense of what we should be covering on the site. So really, it's a way for us to push out our stories, to monitor what people are saying, and also to interact with our audience so that we're not simply using it as a promotional tool, but we're really using it as a way to build some engagement with our readers.
You say that your beat is the media and that you follow people that you get a lot of ideas from and that tweet well. Who are some of the people that you follow that you think you get a lot of value from or from their tweets?
Yeah, good question. So let's see. I'm just looking through TweetDeck right now. And I mean, there are a lot of people on here. I would say Nina Diamond, she is someone who really utilizes lists really well. So you can create Twitter lists. And she actually wrote a piece for us about how to create better Twitter lists. And we asked her because we realized she was so good at creating them. And so she has several journalist lists that she's created. And a lot of times I find some interesting information from her. Another person is Jay Rosen, New York University professor. He often has blog posts that he's written that he links out to on Twitter. And he also is sort of looking for other smart content and then tweeting out a link to it and sometimes sharing his opinion about it. Let's see who else. I would say Chuck Todd. I've always enjoyed following him on Twitter, NBC political correspondent or White House correspondent. And I've actually interviewed him about his use of Twitter because he does a really good job of using it to generate interest around his work. So those are three people just off the top of my head.
So what makes a good Twitter user, do you think?
Well, I think someone who makes a good Twitter user is a person who is able to get their point across succinctly. And I wrote this piece about what Twitter teaches us about writing short and well. And I profiled a few different journalists who do a really good job of using Twitter as a platform, not just to get out information, but to get out really well-written information. And Jennifer Weiner, she's a great example of that. She's a novelist and a former journalist, and she will often tweet out interesting tidbits about the books that she's writing, or sometimes she will live blog particular shows like The Bachelor or The Bachelorette. And her tweets are really kind of snarky, and you can hear the humor in them, and they're really well written. And I will also say David Folkenflik from NPR, he's also a great Twitterer, because what he does is he actually uses Twitter to create mini serial narratives. So a lot of times if he's writing about something, he will tweet out something and he'll say in parentheses at the end of the tweet, 1 out of 4, meaning that he's going to have 4 tweets about this particular topic or this particular idea. And so in that way, he is not necessarily limited to those 140 characters. I mean, each tweet is 140 characters, but he's able to use several tweets in sequence to tell a story. So he does a really good job with that as well.
People on Twitter, you started out this talking about how people were, you know, oh, well, you know, Twitter's only for, you know, people who talk about what they had for lunch. And I also heard a criticism that, well, I've heard a criticism several different times that, you know, well, we're just talking to us. That the journalists are much more obsessed with Twitter than the average person is. And I think, you know, maybe that is true. But I think for a lot of things that you just said are maybe some of the reasons why is that we recognize that as a communications medium, that it's something that's really powerful and immediate. And, you know, we're using it not just to track what each of us is having for lunch, but actually, you know, breaking news, interesting stories, and it's great to see when somebody, some of the people that you mentioned, are actually using it to tell stories in a very different way. I know that's exciting, and us being journalists and talking to ourselves and everything is just sort of a good thing on the side. Do you think that that's that we're the ones who are a little too obsessed with it?
Well, yes, and I think that. Especially as I'm thinking about covering journalists, I mean, I'm lucky in that my sources are using Twitter a lot, but I know that that's not the case for many journalists. I mean, increasingly people are using Twitter and using different social networking sites, so I always encourage journalists to be on these different sites like Twitter and to understand how they work and to use them regularly, because even though some of their audience may not be on these sites right now, eventually they very well maybe. So I think that rather than having to play a catch-up game when your audience does get on these sites, it's better to already be on them and to have an understanding of how they work so that you can be better equipped for when, you know, more readers or more listeners are actually using these sites. And I think some news organizations have found that they are able to use Twitter and that they get some traffic from Twitter, but that Facebook is where they get a lot of their traffic. So part of it is figuring out which platform is best for your news organization and which one your audience is actually using. And one other thing, too, is that with some of these newer social media tools, I've seen some news organizations actually have a little tutorial for their audience. So that way they're not assuming that their audience knows how to use these tools, and instead they're actually showing them how to use them. So, for instance, the Wall Street Journal, they decided that they wanted to do a crowdsourcing project with Pinterest, and they were doing this for the Fashion Week. And so what they did was they wanted their audience to show them sort of what their fashion is like by creating a fashion-related Pinterest board. So on their site, they created just 5 easy steps to let people know how they could create these Pinterest boards, which I thought was really good because it was a small step that they took to really help their readers understand what this tool is and how they could use it.
Well, one of the other things that we've talked about in the past, and I wanted to sort of get your take on it, is, you know, corrections. You know, if you send out a tweet that has an error in it, either factual or spelling or whatever, you know, how best to deal with that?
One of the things that that we found and that there's been some research on is that when there is a correction, usually the misinformation is spread a lot more than the actual correction is spread. So one of the things that's good for news organizations to do is to think about how they can correct information and distribute it on all their platforms. So rather than just putting a correction at the bottom of a story, tweeting out that correction and putting that correction on Facebook or on their mobile platform, wherever it may be, so that the chances that people will see that correction are higher. Typically, with Twitter, it's tough because you can't really delete a tweet. I mean, you can delete it, but it's already out there and people are retweeting it and sharing it still. And I actually talked with Twitter about the possibility of creating a Twitter correction tool, which they weren't all that excited about. I've talked with them about it, and they said that it's something that they had thought about, but it's nothing that they have actually created. But I think it could be useful for journalists just in terms of trying to stop the spread of misinformation. But typically what we do is if we have a correction, then we will put a correction at the bottom of a story. And then if the correction is substantial enough, then sometimes we'll tweet out that correction. Or, you know, it may be something as small as having an incorrect link in a tweet, in which case we'll send out the new link with a correction. And we'll just say corrected link. And so there are some challenges because, you know, there are all these different ways of correcting information on social networks. But I think one of the important things to think about is how your newsroom can create a social media strategy and have social media guidelines. A lot of times we have these ethics guidelines or different guidelines that we're supposed to adhere to, but we create them and then we sort of forget about them. With social media guidelines, they should be living, breathing documents that we're regularly referring to and updating, partly because social media is changing so quickly and also because there are so many challenges associated with social media. So that's something, corrections, that should be addressed in those guidelines.
I'm glad you said something that you said because it allows me to get on a pulpit here. I'm part of the social media group on Facebook, and at one point I sort of had put out a point about social media guidelines for news sites, and it was a little tempest in a teapot. A lot of people were like, guidelines? No, there's no guidelines. And you know, somebody from the New York Times mentioned that. Well, we don't have a standard. You know, we don't have a standard guideline. You know, we have the newspaper has its own guidelines that's developed over years about, you know, sourcing, et cetera, but we don't have anything written down. I think people were afraid of writing anything down about social media because somehow that would put a fence around certain things. And, you know, it just strikes me that, you know, if you're relying on people's knowledge and just doing sensible things, then you're going to get screwed sooner or later, that somebody always makes a mistake. Smart people make mistakes, and, you know, smart people have lost their jobs for making mistakes on social media. So do you think that news organizations should be developing a social media strategy?
I think they should, and I think that they shouldn't just be creating them just so that they can protect themselves. You know, if there's someone in the news organization who tweets something, you don't want to have a policy just so you can say, oh, well, we told them so. Like, they shouldn't have done that. Really, you want to be thinking about how you can create a social media strategy or guidelines that are going to help your staff be more productive in terms of their use of social media and guidelines that will help them make smarter choices. It's helpful, I think, if you can create guidelines that don't start off with a list of don'ts. Mm-hmm. Because it can be really easy to fall into this pattern of saying, oh, well, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. Instead, it's great to think about how can we create guidelines that tell people different ways that they can approach this particular situation on social media, and then provide case studies. National Public Radio created social media guidelines or ethics guidelines that have a social media component last year. And they did a great job of incorporating different best practices that made it easier for people to understand the point that they were making. So I think if you can do that using examples either from within your own news organization or other news organizations, then that can be really helpful for staffers.
Yeah, I know that the newspaper that I used to work for, they had that, I think it was the New York Times guidelines that was their base, but then they had these other additions, and all these additions were things that were based on things that nobody had ever imagined that they would have to write down, guidelines about what, you know, maybe what people shouldn't be doing, and all those came from people doing something stupid or making a mistake and then realizing, well, it hasn't been written down, so maybe we should just write it down so that people understand that, yeah, this might be something to think about. Again, not so much as a don't, but more of a guideline of things to think about that before you write anything, And that's, I think, sort of the same thing with Twitter. You know, it's so easy to write something really quickly and not really think about it. But, you know, you really should be thinking about everything that you put out there, because it's going to it reflects back on you. And if you put out the wrong thing, then, you know, it's going to come back and bite you in the ass.
Right. Yeah. And it should be a preventive measure rather than something that you decide to put together after something problematic happens.
Right. Right, but I think the point I was making is, unfortunately, trying to sit down ahead of time and anticipate the foibles of human nature can sometimes be difficult. So at the end of the day, a lot of these rules get written over a period of time because we uncover them as we move forward. I think there was one, somebody got in trouble because they were tweeting about some woman who was in line in front of him at like a Starbucks or something, and then it turned into a whole big thing. Well, this has been really fascinating, and I appreciate you taking time to talk about social media crowdsourcing and everything that's going on at Poynter. How can people follow you and on Twitter and read your stories?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter at Mallory Tenori, so just MallaryTenore. And then if you go to poynter.org/Mallory, then you can read all my stories there. But I usually am tweeting them out on Twitter, so if you follow me on Twitter, you should be able to see most of them.
It makes everything that much easier. Well, thank you very, very much, Mallory, for talking to us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.